I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. On Friday, a grand jury indicted former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger for the murder of 26-year-old Botham Jean, an unarmed black man.
I look forward to the next step, which is a conviction of murder of Amber Geiger, and more so of a penalty, the proper penalty, that will cause her to reflect on what she has done and the pain that she has caused.
That was Allison Jean, Botham's mother, speaking after the indictment was delivered. Geiger shot and killed Botham in his apartment after she says she confused his apartment with her own. But Geiger's case was preceded by another police indictment. On Thursday, four officers in St. Louis were indicted for beating a black man at a march against police brutality in 2017. Except the man the officers beat wasn't a protester. He was a fellow officer who was undercover.
It's gonna get ignorant tonight.
St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department officer Dustin Boone texted on September 15th, 2017, the day of the verdict.
It's gonna be a lot of fun beating the hell out of these heads once the sun goes down and nobody can tell us apart.
Police indictments in the United States are rare, and we've covered this issue extensively on The Takeaway. But could we be entering a new era of police accountability? Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and also a former cop who collects data on the trends of crimes committed by police. Phil, thanks so much for being with us on The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me back.
So we are looking at the situation in both St. Louis and Dallas. Is there something about these two incidents that stood out to you?
Well, absolutely. There are a few themes here that I think are worth discussing and calling attention to. As to the officers in St. Louis who were indicted several days ago for conspiracy and related charges in the aftermath of the Jason Stockley acquittal, another officer in St. Louis who had been charged with murder. And I think that a few things come to light from this. First, the indictment goes to great lengths to share text messages of the police officers. And, you know, people seem to have their most intimate conversations, their most intimate thoughts, their most unfiltered thoughts in text messages. They don't think that they'll see the light of day. And what we see here is that if you really look closely, we're peeling back the curtain on the police subculture, some of the secrecy issues in the police subculture. And we have officers who are actually excited and boasting about having the opportunity to beat up on people, to use unjustified force at work, to make sure that they've got somebody else there, an old white guy, as the indictment says, to watch, to be an observer, so that they've got somebody to back up their story. And, you know, it's been 25 years since Alan Dershowitz wrote an op-ed in the New York Times where he talked about testifying, where he talked about the fact that everybody knows that many police officers routinely lie and yet nothing is done about it, both in court in terms of perjury and in a police report. So I think there are elements of that here. We've got a lot of falsification going on. We've got a lot of lying going on, and we've got cover-ups. And then I think if we go back and look at the Amber Geiger case, and she was recently indicted in Dallas for murder. She had been previously arrested and charged with manslaughter. I think what we're going to see in that case is that there are a lot of lies that were told, and I think we'll see when it gets to trial as to exactly what the facts are.
I mean, one of the things, as you're describing this, the phrase that keeps coming into my mind is the blue wall that police officers are often, you know, really accused of having, right? This veil of secrecy that covers up pretty much any nefarious behavior in these police departments across the country.
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And, you know, the police typically own the narrative in these incidents. They write the reports, they testify in court, and often there's nobody to rebut their testimony, at least nobody that the court takes seriously in terms of believing an alternate view of things. So what we see is that technology is really peeling back the curtain and allowing us the opportunity to see how police officers really behave when they think nobody of importance is watching.
Has the technology, and I'm sure you're referring to social media, specifically the videos that we've been seeing, the photographs that we see in often, sadly, close enough to the incidents themselves. Do you really think that these videos have had an impact on how people perceive these incidences between, particularly between unarmed black Americans and police?
Absolutely. You know, we've got smartphones. Everybody's got the ability to record videos. We've got body-worn cameras that police officers have, dash cams, and we also have surveillance and security videos that are everywhere. The cameras are everywhere. And it's interesting because the officers often forget that the technology is there. We've seen cases where officers have actually committed crimes that have been recorded by themselves on their own body cameras, and that's a really interesting thing.
I'm wondering also how common, I mean, if we turn to the indictments themselves for a second, how common is it for officers to be indicted in crimes like what we saw in St. Louis and in Dallas?
Well, it's actually very rare. You know, they say that a prosecutor can present a case to a grand jury and that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich, that they simply will take the prosecutor's version and they'll find probable cause. But in the case of police officers, especially when a police officer is accused of committing some sort of on-duty violence, grand juries are very reluctant to indict officers. So it's unlikely. And I also think it's important to remember and step back that I deal with outliers. You know, I've got about 15,000 cases since 2005 in my database of officers across the country who've been arrested for some sort of crime. We had about 1,100 a year. And those are outliers. You know, my father gave me a book when I started this research when I was working on my PhD dissertation, and it was a book about police heroes, and it had stories throughout the book, and there was an inscription he wrote in the front of the book just reminding me that not all cops are bad cops, and I think it's important to point that out.
And so, no, I mean, understandably so, not all cops are bad cops, but I'm just wondering, are you seeing more? Can we expect more, given the context that we just talked about, the increase in video surveillance, the increase in video proof, body cameras, dash cams, cell phone cams, the sort of change that we're noticing in how Americans might be viewing violence against Black communities in particular by police officers? Are we expecting more indictments for nefarious and violent behavior from police officers?
Well, in terms of the fatal police shootings, we now know that between 900 and 1,000 times each and every year, on-duty police officers shoot and kill someone. And yet only a handful of times each year is an officer charged with murder or manslaughter. We've had about 94 officers since 2005 who've been charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting. But in those cases, we're not seeing any trends with more officers being charged, more officers going to trial. But I do think we're seeing one thing different with technology and one thing different in terms of the public paying attention now. And that's that investigators and prosecutors are paying very close attention. You know, a dead man can't talk. The police always used to own the narrative. And now what we see is that there's often an alternative narrative where we've got different types of technology that can really blow holes in the stories if, in fact, they are stories and not truthful narratives in terms of what police officers have done in terms of their on-duty behaviors and trying to write things up to justify whatever actions they've taken. So I think as time goes on, we're going to see that the technology advances and that we're going to have more opportunities for prosecutors to take a very close look in this case. And we'll just have to see over time where the trends go.
Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University. Phil, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Housing migrant children along the U.S.-Mexico border is not only a major policy debate, it's also a big business. For one charity, Southwest Key, housing migrant children has translated to $1.7 billion in federal grant money over the past 10 years. And in 2017, the group's chief executive, Juan Sanchez, made $1.5 million. A report published over the weekend in the New York Times detailed Southwest Key's financial practices and how the organization has exploited a lack of government oversight to profit off of the border crisis in recent years. Kim Barker is one of the reporters who investigated Southwest Key for the New York Times, and she's here with us in studio. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a sense for how many shelters does Southwest Key run? And we started hearing about this a lot, I think, over the summer, right? They became sort of a household name. Tell us who they are and how many shelters they have around the country.
Well, over the summer, at their maximum, they had 26 shelters, all in Texas, Arizona, and California, housing probably about 5,800 migrant children. And two of those have since been shut down. So now they have 24 shelters throughout throughout those three states. And their story is a story of a nonprofit that started about 30 years ago, founded by this man, Juan Sanchez, specifically to try to keep juveniles out of prisons, out of jails, right? And to keep them in the community and to help juveniles. And then at some point, it entered the shelter business, and that's where it derives most of its money from now.
So this is a billion-dollar, mm-hmm. Almost $2 billion business. Sanchez, who you mentioned, was paid $1.5 million running the organization. For those of us who, including myself, who are not as familiar, is that a typical salary for running a nonprofit charity?
It's not a typical salary for running a nonprofit. And, there are outliers and folks who even make more than that, who run hospitals and medical facilities. But for a charity that exists on taxpayer dollars, this salary is just far outside the median.
So what's at issue here? Southwest does receive federal funding.
Yes.
What is at issue in terms of what did your investigation uncover? Is it that these funds are being misused or that they're not being appropriated to where they need to be?
Well, we looked a lot at how they run their shelters and who owns those shelters. And when you're looking at a nonprofit, it's important to see whether they actually own the buildings or who's getting the rent for those particular buildings. So that's something that the story takes a long look at. In its last tax return, they spent $25 million on occupancy, on rent. That's a lot of money. And so we looked at who was getting that money and the different developers that Southwest Key was working with. And one of those shelters is, in fact, owned in part by Mr. Sanchez and by his chief financial officer, which is also one of those things that raised red flags for us and for the charity experts we talked to. They have for-profit companies they run as well that pay very high management fees back to the charity. And there's just a lot of money sloshing around in there. They're sitting on more than $61 million as of their last tax return, just cash, just sitting on it. And that's a lot of money extra left over from these federal grants.
So that's $61 million in federal grants that could be used to do what right now? Actually take care of these kids, maybe provide them with legal services, all that stuff.
Sure. But it has to have federal oversight. There's got to be somebody looking at how the money is spent. And it's not up to me as a reporter to say, well, they could be doing this with it, because they actually have contracts that say what they're supposed to be doing with it. And that, I think, is the real question. Where has the federal government been in this? And we certainly know from our reporting that the government has started taking a look at how this money is spent, right? They shut down one charity's shelters back in February, and that was a charity called International Educational Services. And we know the FBI is investigating that charity as well for doing, some similar things, paying higher than the salary cap that is supposed to be allowed for migrant shelter grants, and also, doing property dealings with themselves. And I believe at least they say they're looking at this now, and we'll just have to see what happens from that. But I think for a long time, this was seen as a crisis in housing them. Where do we put these kids, right? And it seems like there just wasn't a lot of checking as to what happens next and what happens with the money. And that's really what we were trying to look at.
And there seems to be a lot of concern, like you said, over where do we put the kids?
Yeah.
But if there's all this money in the bank, or so to speak, then I'm curious about how this is being doled out. The other issue with Southwest Key is that there have been a few physical and sexual abuse allegations against shelter employees.
Yes.
The Times has also covered this previously. Is there any connection there? Is there any government oversight over that area? If there's isn't any oversight over the money? Who has oversight over what's happening to these children?
It's a really good question. You have, in fact, there were recent stories about the fact that, doing background checks for the workers at the tent city in Texas just isn't that much of a priority, because we got to get this thing running, right? And you have the sense that there was just some playing loose, fast and loose with the rules a little bit in Arizona, where Southwest Key got in trouble for missing a deadline to submit proof of background checks. And that got them in trouble with the state and eventually led to an agreement where they shuttered two of their shelters. But you have to wonder, if they're not checking folks as thoroughly as possible, whether certain people can slip into work there, because it's obviously a very vulnerable population, right? You've got migrant kids, many of whom don't speak English at all. Who are they going to call if something goes wrong? And I think that is a real question. We have no idea, in fact, what goes on inside the shelters, because you can't get inside them. They're shelters for children.
And the reporting has shown, and was saying that this Sanchez in particular and Southwest Key are really key, no pun intended,
right,
to this issue that we're having at the border. How important is their relationship with the Trump administration and moving forward?
Well, they definitely grew a lot during the Obama administration, and they've worked very closely with every single administration, and that seems to have continued.
Kim Barker is a reporter for The New York Times. Kim, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, the G20 summit at Argentina came to a close on Saturday. And the big question is, have the U.S. and China reached a deal, a trade truce? Well, joining us to give us a roundup of what we saw at the G20 is Alex Lawson. He's a senior reporter on international trade with Law 360 and the co-host of Law 360's Pro Se podcast. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's talk about China and President Trump. These discussions, as we talked about last week, were highly anticipated. What did they walk away with?
Well, they walked away with probably what was the most likely outcome for the summit. There really wasn't a good chance of any tariffs actually being removed. They've both put up a lot of bluster in that regard, and they weren't going to back down. But they agreed to halt installing new tariffs for a period of 90 days. And over the next 90 days, they're going to hold more intensive discussions to sort of address these U.S. demands. And those are largely in the realm of China's intellectual property rules, these rules that require companies to hand over technology and sensitive IP as a condition of doing business there. Some other things, but it's sort of it puts a halt on the tariffs as we understand them now and tees up a more intensive round of discussions over the next 3 months.
So no new tariffs right now, but what about the tariffs we talked about last week, the iPhone, iPad, all the sort of Trump wanted to put all these tariffs on China manufactured technologies. Are those even part of the picture going forward? Or
those again, that was sort of the sort of Damocles hanging over the tariff landscape. And again, under this arrangement, those will be held off for now. Also, I neglected to mention, in addition to no new tariffs, there was a provision that the latest round of tariffs, it was set only at 10%, and at the end of the year, it was supposed to jump to 25%. Now, they're not going to do that. That's probably the most significant thing that happened, actually. They agree, not only are we not imposing new tariffs, we're not even going to raise the ones we have on. So the product coverage remains the same. The sort of more palatable 10% level, people who are free trade backers would like it to be zero, but it was a welcome result, at least in the near term.
So, of course, we can't talk about the president without talking about a tweet. And this morning, the president tweeted, quote, "Farmers will be a very, very big and fast beneficiary of our deal with China. They intend to start purchasing agricultural product immediately," wrote the president. What is he talking about?
Well, it's interesting that he said that. I saw that tweet and wrinkled my nose a bit because the largest barriers in China to U.S. agriculture products, at least recently, have been the tariffs they put in place in response to the tariffs that the United States put in place. So this has happened a couple different times where the Trump administration will kind of create a problem, back their way into a solution, and then the president takes credit for it. Now, there's been market access issues with agriculture in China for years, but that's what he's talking about there. They sort of got a verbal commitment from China to buy more U.S. Farm goods, food.
So are they hoping like wheat and corn and the things that soy? Like, what do they want to buy?
Yeah, things like that. Soybeans has been a big one. But again, I'm sure that the U.S. farming sector would just prefer that the U.S. lowers its barriers so that China lowers its barriers and they can just sort of trade freely rather than sort of get China in a wrist lock at the negotiating table and demand that they buy our wheat and corn and things like that.
Doesn't sound like a good negotiating tool. Before we wrap, there was a declaration of 31 points that all countries signed. Can you give us a sense of what that was?
Yeah, that was very interesting. So we talked a little bit last week about the need to reform the World Trade Organization.
That's what we talked about. Yeah.
And all the G20 members agreed to do that, so they're doing that. However, it did leave out some language that has been a fixture of those statements in the past, like a commitment to the multilateral trading system and, importantly, a vow against imposing new trade barriers. Now, that's been a fixture of these statements like that. It was left out this time, so you can see the Trump administration sort of starting to work its way on the global stage.
Alex Lawson is a senior reporter on international trade with Law 360 and the co-host of Law 360's Pro Se podcast. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut, aged-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, two savory premium pork chops, four chicken fried steaks, four Omaha Steaks burgers, four snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, four perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, four made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get four more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Cash or card? In some businesses across the country, that question no longer applies. And you may have noticed your local coffee shop or ice cream spot going cashless recently. A 2017 survey by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or the FDIC, found that roughly 8.4 million U.S. households don't have a bank account, which means that when you're a business that goes cashless, it's kind of like telling some Americans, you're not welcome here. Last week, here in New York City, Councilmember Richie J. Torres proposed legislation that would fine cashless establishments. A similar bill is currently under review by the Washington, D.C. City Council, and New Jersey lawmakers are considering a statewide cashless ban. Malo Andre Hudson is an associate professor at Columbia University and director of the Urban Community and Health Equity Lab, and I asked him about the growing trend of businesses that say no to cash.
This has become very common. I also have experienced this in New York City and elsewhere. I think as you see new businesses opening up, we are moving towards a more cashless society, and many have just decided that we are not going to take cash at all and just focus on credit or debit cards.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because here in New York, we mentioned that Councilmember Richie Torres is proposing legislation that tells them they have to accept cash. And last week, he told the website Grub Street that there is, quote, an insidious racism that underlies a cashless business model. And he added that cashless businesses disempower communities of color. Help us understand what Torres is talking about, please.
Well, what Councilmember Torres is really talking about is the millions of Americans that are unbanked or underbanked. These are people who either don't trust banks, don't have enough money to open a bank account, have privacy concerns, or really are concerned about the fees that they would have to pay. And so they would rather use cash. And so when you shift to a system that says we are cashless only, you are basically assuming that people have access to a financial institution that can provide them with a credit card, a debit card, or some type of plastic in order to carry out that transaction.
I'd love to break those down a little bit more, those issues that you just brought out, because I think a lot of folks think most of us, if not all of us, are paying with Apple Pay or with our phones or with debit cards. But you mentioned a couple of issues that the unbanked really deal with, particularly poor communities of color. Privacy. What do you mean by privacy?
Well, oftentimes you have to show your documentation, whether you are, your financial records or your identity and so forth. And some people don't feel comfortable doing that. Some people are concerned about all the hacks and the data breaches that have occurred, and they would rather operate from just having cash. You see that among immigrant communities, communities of color, people who just have either had bad experiences with financial institutions. It wasn't that long ago that we just had our financial crisis where people were paying more for higher interest rates. There were all kinds of scandals with vulnerable populations being taken advantage of through predatory lending and high interest rates. And so there is a fear among people, certainly privacy concerns about sharing information or just not trusting banks altogether in terms of they'll be paying more fees, they will pay more for transaction costs. And so there is a concern there.
And I think there's also a concern along the lines of privacy, at least for me, which is these organizations, whether they be banks or small businesses or whoever, will then have all of this data on my purchasing history, which kind of makes me slightly uncomfortable. From an economic perspective, though, are there good reasons to go cashless, at least for businesses or for people?
Well, for businesses, I think they see the trend that's happening, not only in the United States, but globally. We are moving towards a cashless society. We know that technology is advancing in a sense that you have all these different platforms to pay and do transactions. And I think for the most part, many businesses think about it's more efficient, it's convenient, they're keeping up with the times. I've even seen people argue that it has to do with hygiene, and certainly the transaction of money can be quite dirty, especially in a food establishment, as well as just the fact that it reduces security risks. So if we have cash registers with cash sitting there, you have to then figure out ways to get that to the bank. You don't have to worry about people coming in and robbing you the same way. And so there are a number of concerns from the business perspective that I've heard.
But doesn't this sort of create a two-tier system of customers in some way?
Absolutely. When you're saying that we only take plastic, you are excluding those who do not have a relationship with a financial institution or people who frankly just choose to use cash for all kinds of reasons. Those are personal reasons. And I do think you are excluding people, especially low-income people or the low and middle-income populations that prefer to use cash.
Now, there is one interesting statistic. We mentioned the millions of people in the United States who are unbanked, but that number is actually going down. Are you seeing that as a positive trend for low-income communities, for low-income people of color? Is it that more people are being engaging with banks, or is it that they're just not dealing with banks at all?
You know, it's hard to say. I think the focus should be on how do we create a system that supports low to moderate income individuals so that they can have a financial institution, a banking account or a savings account that's safe and secure, that has low transactional cost and allows people who of less means to be able to make it in today's society. And I think that's the bigger focus we should be thinking about is how do we focus on the unbanked and the underbanked and help them feel like they're not marginalized in society or excluded, but in fact included.
A lot of businesses that go into gentrifying neighborhoods might already be excluding a lot of the current residents who tend to be low income through their prices, regardless of whether they accept cash or not. Should high prices in general be more of a focus than just this issue of being cashless?
Well, I think when we look at the high prices and certainly the new businesses that are moving into areas that are going through significant neighborhood change or what many might call gentrification, we have to look at who the backers are, right? We're moving away from the mom and pop shops, those that might be financed through relatives or friends, and actually looking at bigger investors now are behind the new restaurants, behind the cafes, and they expect a certain return on their investment. And so whether you're in New York City or San Francisco or Dallas, whatever the hot new place is that's opening up oftentimes has investors behind them. There's a certain feel to the place, and they are basically catering to a certain clientele.
And as far as Congressman Torres's approach, do you think we're going to see more politicians getting involved in this fight and saying no to cashless businesses?
I think it's hard to say what will happen in the future, but I think what it does is it changes the conversation. It says we are no longer just going to keep excluding these populations and actually have a conversation about how we bank or don't bank, how people have access to credit or not, and to savings accounts and so forth. So I think it may change the overall conversation about the types of businesses that are moving into the community and the relationship that they have with neighborhood residents. I think it's going to change the conversation around you know, how we engage with populations in general, how we think about transactions, and the importance of using the technologies that are being developed to improve access for everyone and not just for those who can afford it.
Malo Andre Hudson is an associate professor at Columbia University. Malo, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
I think kindness is a way of being.
Most things that are done out of kindness is basically done out of love.
I think it's a behavior, a skill. It's glue. It's essential.
Kindness.
Tonight, an act of kindness at a rental car company in Tulsa goes just viral.
One really big random act of kindness.
Kindness is caring enough about others that we treat them with gentleness, graciousness, and generosity.
New tonight, a police officer's random act of kindness isn't going unnoticed.
Good and generous and sacrificing.
Once you start being kind to people, they feel better and it just spreads.
A few weeks ago, here at The Takeaway, we asked you to send us some stories of people being kind. And boy, did you deliver.
My name is Elena Forsetti. I'm from Clifton, New Jersey, and I'm calling because of the act of kindness mentioned on the radio.
Hi, this is Charlie from New London, Connecticut. I'm calling because you are asking for altruistic stories.
I wanted to give my takeaway on moments of kindness.
And I'm calling about the NICE project.
I'm calling with a story of kindness.
So today, we're kicking off our series, America the Kind. And we're starting with a call from a listener that really touched us.
This is Elton Folland in Ozona, Florida. And my daughter died about a year ago. And after she died, I was having a lot of difficulties. And even though I was a psychotherapist and had psychotherapist friends, the receptionist at the gym talked to me 3 or 4 times a week, just for 10 or 15 minutes a time. and she did a much better job than even my psychotherapist colleagues. And it was a wonderful thing that she did.
For our series, we wanted to hear from both the giver and the receiver of the kindness. So that's how I ended up talking with Elton Follett, who you just heard, and Jen Taylor, the receptionist at Family Fitness in Dunedin, Florida. Hi, this is Tanzina Vega. I'm the host of The Takeaway. Do I have Elton and Jen on the line?
Yes, you do.
Hello.
Hi, how are you both?
We're fine. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. I'm excited to have this conversation with you, and I really appreciate you both agreeing to do this with us. It's really special.
My pleasure.
So, Elton, take us back to where you were about a year ago. You were going through a pretty difficult time.
Yes. A little over a year ago, my eldest daughter died, and it was a very difficult cancer. And I was coming into the gym three times a week, and I found myself talking to Jen for 10 or 15 minutes every time I came in.
And what brought you to the gym? Like, what was it that you were...
Well, I'd broken my hip before that, and the physiotherapist said I should go in three times a week. And for 25 years, I taught psychotherapists, and I had five or six psychotherapist friends I could talk to, but it seemed to work out much better talking to Jen.
Jen, I want to ask you, when you saw Elton, was there something that made you want to just strike up a conversation with him? What's your first recollection of Elton?
Well, Elton came to the gym as a new member, and like all new members, I try to make them feel comfortable and encourage them. And I'm very outgoing. I'm very naturally friendly. But he was very funny and intelligent, and I enjoyed our conversations. So I look forward to them, actually.
I think Jen is being modest. She has the memory for 200 first names and 200 last names. And I find that amazing because sometimes I even forget my friends' names.
Well, thank you, Elton.
What were some of the things you initially started talking about?
Oh, everything from the weather to cooking to how he really didn't want to work out, but he'd rather snorkel. It's one of his favorite hobbies.
And Elton, what did those conversations, as they started to happen, were you surprised? Was it just sort of a casual thing initially, just sort of, you know, having these random conversations as you're headed to the gym or headed to the supermarket or wherever you might be headed?
Well, it was just a very nice therapeutic time where we could talk about anything, and I didn't have to think about the terrible things that had gone on or the death of my daughter. And Jennifer is just very natural. I keep telling her she should be a life coach or something like that because she could make a lot more money, and she's, you know, really talented that way.
Oh, thank you, Elton.
Was there a point at which the conversations, Jen, shifted maybe from the weather and, you know, how was your weekend to what Elton was dealing with, to the grief that he was dealing with?
Oh, yes. As we became better friends, our conversation naturally got deeper, and he was able to share some of his emotions with me. And I was, you know, there to listen and empathize with him as well. My mother is always asking to meet Elton, and she thinks that our relationship is just very unique and very cute, actually.
Now, Elton, you don't go to the gym anymore, is that right?
Oh, I hated the gym. The only good thing about the gym was talking to Jen. And I snorkel or kayak six times a week, and that's much, much better than working with a machine.
But you still talk, obviously, and I'm wondering, did you know, Jen, that you were having an impact on Elton? Were you aware that those brief conversations were affecting him in a good way?
Yes, absolutely. I think both of us knew that. It was just pleasure talking with him and seeing him. He still comes to visit me every once in a while, even though he's not a member, which is nice.
I'm wondering, you know, we're doing this series of episodes on the show, and it's really about kindness. And your story stood out to us because these are interactions that often seem so small in our daily lives. And yet for you, Elton, and also for you, Jennifer, this small interaction became so much bigger.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was certainly a major effect in my healing process. And I think I would have grieved much longer and much harder if it hadn't been for Jen.
Oh, Elton, thank you for that.
Now, I'm wondering, because the two of you are so kind to each other, do you have advice on how people can bring more kindness into their own lives, more kindness into the lives of others? What would you say from this small interaction? What advice would you have?
Well, I think a smile goes a long way. Just the common courtesies of, you know, holding the door open or, you know, listening to people. It's the small things that may possibly lead to, you know, a friendship or more kindness, you know, on a different level.
Are you aware of that too, Jen? Are you aware that those little moments of kindness are that important?
Yes.
When you do them?
Yes, I feel it, you know, especially from, you know, some of our older clients that, you know, don't get a lot of attention. Maybe their children don't live nearby. I feel like I get to be their surrogate, you know, child.
And what about you, Elton?
Oh yes. I think that once you start being kind to people, they feel better and they're kind to their family and people around them, and it just spreads.
It's a ripple effect, in my opinion.
And it's much better than the opposite, because that spreads the same way, too.
Yes.
If you do the opposite and you're nasty to people, then they become nasty. And if you just listen and be somewhat sympathetic and, you know, try to respond in a reasonable way rather than just an emotional way.
I think we're doing a lot of that, and I admire you both. This is a lovely story. I really appreciate you both for sharing it with us. Elton and Jen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elton Follett is a retired psychotherapist living in Ozona, Florida, and Jen Taylor is the receptionist at Family Fitness in Dunedin, Florida. And do you have a story about an act of goodness or kindness? Give us a call with your nominations for America the Kind at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or head to thetakeaway.org and fill out the little form we've got there. And do us a favor, notice the kindness out there today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.